With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Klamath farmers hope to finish harvest before water supplies run out. Farmers relying on water supplies from the federal Klamath Water Project say they are trying to finish harvest before their water supply is cut off in the coming weeks. Scott Sues of Tule Lake-based Sues Farm, which grows horseradish, onions, mint, and grain, says the growers face water shortages again this season, despite a plentiful water year. That's because the Klamath Water Users Association had expected a water delivery of 285,000 acre-feet this year. Instead, irrigators got an initial allocation of 215,000 acre-feet. Still, that's vastly improved over last year's 50,000 acre-feet supply. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Some county minimum wage rates differ than the state's. The statewide minimum wage rate is set to increase 50 cents from $15.50 to $16 come January of 2024. However, AgSafe President and CEO Teresa Keene says some counties in California are already more than the state standard.
Local cities and counties can also have their own minimum wages that are above and beyond what the state requires. So, for example, if you are in Half Moon Bay, it is $16.45 an hour. Santa Rosa, which we've got a lot of folks in our wine industry are up there, their minimum wage is $17.06 an hour. So you want to make sure that you are also taking a look at the cities and the counties that you're working in and ensure that you are meeting their minimum wage as well.
Stay tuned as we'll hear more from Keene later in today's interview segment of our show. But for right now, here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
Researchers at Cal Poly Humboldt will be using a $500,000 grant to take a closer look at cattle grazing and its impact on wetlands. The 501c3 research organization of California Farm Bureau, the California Bountiful Foundation, has awarded a $520,000 grant to support the research led by Humboldt Professor of Rangeland Resource Science, Dr. Justin Long. The objectives for the project include assessing the benefit managed grazing can provide for wetland plant and wildlife communities at the Willits Bypass and utilize existing data to determine the impact of excluding historical grazing on wetland plant communities. Overall, the project will be assessing site hydrodynamics, hydrology, soil carbon, and nitrogen to develop longer-term models to evaluate plant productivity in relation to grazing. The collaborative effort includes partnerships with the Mendocino County Resource Conservation District and the Mendocino County Farm Bureau. The Blue Diamond USDA Climate Smart Grant Program is helping to further the goals of their Orchard Stewardship Incentive Program. Senior Director of Sustainability for Blue Diamond, Dan Sonke, describes how the two programs complement each other in providing a variety of benefits to growers.
Our members can receive a higher price per pound of almond for going through the Almond Board of California's California Almond Stewardship Platform. So this is the industry sustainable agriculture platform that engages growers across a wide array of sustainable ag issues and allows us to document where we are as a co-op on adopting those practices. Grower data is kept private. We don't see individual grower data, but by participating, we get a cumulative data set that we can use to share with our customers and interact with other stakeholders on how we're doing on sustainability. So that's working in partnership with these grant dollars. So we do ask all of our growers who want to get the grant dollars to also do the Orchard Stewardship Incentive Program. That provides additional benefits for us. It provides a higher price for them. So everybody wins, we hope. And then actually it also benefits the entire almond industry because that data, again, grower data is protected and private, but the data cumulatively helps the entire industry portray the good growing practices of California almonds to our markets around the world.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, about 3% of agricultural land in the United States is currently owned by foreign entities. But U.S. Senator Kevin Cramer, a Republican from North Dakota, says even that may be too much.
One would think that's not a very high percentage, but it's obviously a lot of acres. And what's more probably somewhat alarming is that how quickly in recent years that acreage has increased. That there's clearly has been a concerted effort in recent years to purchase productive land by foreign entities, particularly China. So I wouldn't say there is, frankly, a percentage that I'm comfortable with, because I just think we've got to protect our own land, because once it's gone, it can be gone forever. And what we really don't want to do is start, taking it back, if you will, or passing retroactive legislation, things like that. So I think the sooner we recognize the potential issue down the road, something, by the way, we didn't anticipate when we let China enter WTO and we gave them, favored nation status, hopeful that somehow our free market capitalism system would splash over on them, only to wake up, decades later and find out they steal technology, they extort, things from countries, including land, ports, whatever they can, with predatory financing tools. They require, in the case of investment, oftentimes, or doing business in their country, they require the transfer of intellectual property. So, I don't think we can wait around and say, okay, we'll let you have up to 10% or 5% or whatever the percentage may be. I think we have to slow this whole thing down, right now, and try not to let them grow their influence in certain aspects of our economy.
Senator Cramer is a co-sponsor of the Farm Act, known in long form as the Foreign Adversary Risk Management Act. He says it's a matter of security on several levels.
I just think for land in particular, we can't grow more. We need to control our own food supply because it's so critical. And then the fact that trade can be such a valuable tool in terms of both world peace and just moral obligation, and we're so darn good at producing food, I think we ought to keep as much of it, in American producers' hands as possible.
The Farm Act would increase the U.S. agriculture industry's role on the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS, which is the government body responsible for overseeing the foreign investment and acquisition of American companies.
It's designed to prevent improper foreign interference in agriculture, specifically by really heightening agriculture's presence on the CFIUS board. So CFIUS, the Committee for Foreign Investment in the United States, is a committee that's headed by the Treasury Department, includes several national security and intelligence agencies, maybe not so much intelligence as national security agencies, along with commerce, to review certain foreign investments in the United States.
The agriculture secretary would be brought in on proposed acquisitions that involve agriculture. The bicameral bipartisan legislation is led by Senator Tommy Tuberville, a Republican in Alabama, and Representative Ronnie Jackson, a Republican from Texas. Original co-sponsors in the House also included Democrat Representatives Jim Costa and Jimmy Panetta, both of California, along with several others. Cramer says even if the bill never gets to a vote, it has brought awareness to the issue and started discussions on land acquisitions by foreign entities. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the U.S. Department of Agriculture did release their August 2023 cattle on feed report. It shows the number of cattle and calves on feed for the slaughter market in the U.S. for feedlots with a capacity of 1,000 or more head at 11 million head on August 1st. That's 2% below August 1 of last year. And according to a report from Gary Crawford, there are no signs of a cattle herd expansion in this report.
Friday's report shows it's obvious supplies of cattle are getting a little thin. The report says producers during July placed fewer cattle in feedlots than analysts expected, 1.62 million head, a full 8% below July a year ago, and it's no wonder. USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham says,
we are talking about a smaller pool of cattle outside feedlots. So, I mean, the number of cattle outside feedlots on July 1st was down about 4%. To some extent, that's going to be reflected in the fact that producers placed fewer cattle.
Shagham says the feedlot inventory August 1st was 11 million head, 2% below a year ago. So the herd contraction seems to continue despite some very high prices for cattle, both feeder and fed cattle. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. And USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham says the supply of forage is the key to any eventual cattle herd expansion.
The cow-calf operators' returns have been relatively good, from recent past. There should be some, if they have grass, there might be some incentives to expand. But again, it's a question of whether or not they have the forage to carry their animals over the winter for breeding in the spring.
Now, placements in feedlots during July at 1.62 million head was 8% below last year. Net placements at 1.55 million head. During July, placements in cattle and calves weighing less than 600 pounds were 365,000 head, 600 to 699 pounders at 250,000, 700 to 799 pounders, 370,000, 800 to 899 pounders at 373,000 head, 900 to 999 pounders at 185,000 head, while 1,000 pounds or greater were only 75,000 head. Marketing of fed cattle during July at 1.73 million head was 5% below 2022. And U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson introduced the Beef Origin Labeling Accountability Act to bring clarity and to reinstate mandatory country of origin labeling, or MCOOL, for beef products. He said consumers don't know where their beef come from. It could be South Dakota, Brazil, or Canada. U.S. producers raise better beef and they're not getting credit for it. The act would direct the U.S. Trade Representative and U.S. Secretary to work together to determine a process of reinstating mandatory country of origin labeling for beef that is compliant with World Trade Organizational rules. It also directs the U.S. Trade Representative to consult with the Canadian and Mexican governments to resolve the outstanding MCOOL trade disputes the two countries have open against the U.S. Johnson added, this bill is a step in the right direction to get accurate labels back on these products. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
It's an ag conference like no other. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The date is set for the 2024 U.S. Worm Farm Conference. More than 50 worm farms from all over the world will meet in Phoenix, Arizona next January 11th and 12th at the Arizona Worm Farm for the third annual Worm Farm Business Conference. The conference will focus on how to start, expand, or perfect worm composting and waste reduction. The wholesale price of worms has jumped from $15 per pound in 2020 to an average of more than $45 a pound today. Demand now significantly exceeds supply. Global climate change, combined with dramatically increased interest in organic waste reduction, and a desire to create sustainable, productive soils for agriculture, has led to a global shortage of worms and worm products. Zach Brooks, the owner and founder of the Arizona Worm Farm, said, "There's never been a better time to build or expand a worm farming business. Prices have never been higher and demand has never been greater," he said. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. Farmland can be owned in an IRA, but should it? What if you want to continue farming the land? What if you finance the land purchase? I'll be back in a moment to discuss the issues with holding farmland in an IRA.
Kansas State University's Master of Agribusiness program blends online learning with face-to-face opportunities so you can gain the skills you need to make better business decisions on the farm or in the boardroom. Learn more at mab.ksu.edu.
I'll get back to the report in a moment, but I want you to know that Schrader Real Estate and Auction Company has sold farm and ranch land and farm equipment in 40 states. Learn how the Schrader family can help your family. Visit SchraderAuction.com. That's S-C-H-R-A-D-E-R Auction.com. Many farmers who want to buy land and hold it in an IRA or retirement account also want to farm the land. In many situations, the farmland purchase is financed. The problem with farming or financing land held in an IRA is that it will likely cause the IRA to be fully taxable. Many actions are prohibited when land is owned by an IRA. For starters, you or anyone closely related to you can't farm the land. You can't even personally do any work on the land, such as mowing grass waterways or painting a barn or doing any maintenance. Also, rent should be based on fair market value. If you borrow funds to buy the land, you can't personally guarantee the debt. If you do finance the purchase, part of your rental income will be subject to income tax, and the IRA will need to file an income tax return. You'll also need to find an IRA custodian to handle the transaction and the ongoing ownership of the land and pay fees. The land will have to be appraised every year, and once you turn 72, you may need to partially distribute the land annually. Do you still want to own land in an IRA? You can do it, but for most people, it's just not a good idea. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
Extreme heat and wetness. Quite a contrast weather-wise when it came to July 2023. So how does National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration records compare this past month with other Julys in climate categories going back 129 years? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey starts with the thermometer, moving in the direction of high temperatures.
It is going to turn out to be the 11th hottest July. The monthly average temperature for the lower 48 states, just shy of 76 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 2 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century mean.
The extreme heat was reflected in both all-time July high temperatures by state.
We do have four states, those being Arizona, New Mexico, Florida, and Maine, reporting their hottest July on record. If you look at states that made it into the near record territory for the month of July, top 10 all-time, it's a quite long list of states, mainly across the South and the Northeast.
And by metropolitan area.
Phoenix, Arizona became the first major American city to report a monthly average temperature greater than 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And then we saw hottest month on record, if you look all across the South, extending all the way from Phoenix and Las Vegas into West Texas, where we saw El Paso doing the same all-time hottest month. And then to the Gulf Coast, cities like Baton Rouge, on through the Atlantic Coast, Miami, all coming in with their hottest month on record.
Yet parts of the country reported cooler than normal average temperatures for July as well.
We did see relatively cool conditions for at least the first 3 weeks of the month across the Northern Plains and Upper Midwest. When you rank those 129 years, it was actually the 27th coolest July in North Dakota. We saw somewhere in the top 40 for coolest July in four other North Central states, including South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, and Minnesota.
With varying degrees of temperatures recorded in July, precipitation accumulations cross-country were also mixed last month. The net result was the 45th driest July in 129 years of record keeping.
The real core wet area during July stretched from the central Great Plains eastward through the Ohio Valley and into the Northeast. Pretty much everybody around that core wet area had a relatively dry month.
On a state level,
we did see top 10 wetness in Oklahoma, along with Michigan and several northeastern states. But on the flip side, an extremely dry month in the upper Midwest. It was the third driest July in Minnesota. We also saw a number of western states reporting very quiet conditions. It was the third driest July in Arizona and Idaho, the fourth driest in New Mexico, and the sixth driest in California.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Unused prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble. They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for, harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet, or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Pro Farmer Crop Tour continues, and so does hot, dry weather across most of the country. I'm Mark Oppold with today's Bottom Line Report, brought to you by Helena. High temperatures remain over 90 degrees well into the northern belt as well. Fargo, North Dakota, expecting a high 90, 92 degrees tomorrow and again Wednesday. Pro Farmer Crop Scouts are enduring one of the hottest tour weeks in recent memory, and they're reporting conditions that differ slightly from USDA's weekly update. Farm Progress Show starts a week from today, Decatur, Illinois. It'll be still dry, but not as hot. December corn starts to look toppy in our view, above 510, 512, but will be supported by November soybeans, challenging those highs from mid-July above 1410, 1415. September Kansas City wheat may have seen its high for the week already yesterday, just above a 761 level. This is the Bottom Line Report. Right now, with soil-enhancing humic compounds like Resurge, visit HelenaAgri.com to learn more. Cattle and hog movement will be reduced to early morning hours another day, heat stress being reported in some Plains feedlots. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
What's a Category 4 hurricane? Now remnants.
Hurricane Hilary, in its remnant form as a tropical storm, became the first tropical cyclone since September of 1939 to have an inland tropical storm position over California,
occurring near Palm Springs late Sunday afternoon. A later advisory was issued for western Nevada.
It is now a post-tropical cyclone, no longer fully tropical.
Yet impacts are evident in those areas, including
excessive rainfall, meaning about a year's worth of rain falling in just a day's time. Those 4 to 8 inch rainfall totals in the deserts of Southern California has led to some significant flash flooding and debris flows, quite a few road closures.
Plus wind-related impacts.
We actually did see some pretty impressive winds on the eastern side of the circulation.
In areas such as Yuma, Arizona and Imperial, California, recording 60-plus mile-per-hour winds. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
How much of our U.S. ag land should belong to our adversaries? About 3% of agricultural land in the United States is owned by foreign entities. But U.S. Senator Kevin Cramer, a Republican from North Dakota, says even that may be too much. He's a co-sponsor of the Farm Act, known in long form as the Foreign Adversary Risk Management Act. He says it's a matter of security on several levels.
I just think for land in particular, we can't grow more. We need to control our own food supply because it's so critical. And then the fact that trade can be such a valuable tool in terms of both world peace and just moral obligation, and we're so darn good at producing food, I think we ought to keep as much of it, you know, in American producers' hands as possible.
Hear the whole interview and read the story on our website, agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
It's that time of year again already.
All across the country, parents are getting ready to send their kids to school.
That's Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Xochitl Torres-Small, and she says while parents and students are getting ready for school, so are school food service people preparing to feed those students. It's estimated that every school day, some 30 million kids will partake of the national school lunch and breakfast programs.
And that's typically the healthiest meal that child will eat that day.
in some cases, the only meals they'll get. So Secretary Small says working in school food service is a big job, a lot of responsibility, huge challenges.
And particularly in rural places, when you've got a smaller population and lower student size, it becomes even more difficult to be able to pull together the funds to have an operating kitchen that has all of the necessities to make sure that meal can be as healthy as possible and as tasty as possible.
And stay on budget as much as possible. That's where a special agriculture department program comes into play.
The Healthy Meals Incentives Initiative.
It's a grant program,
which in partnership with USDA and Action for Healthy Kids is awarding nearly $30 million in grants all across the country to 264 school districts across 44 states, as well as the District of Columbia, reaching students in some of our country's highest need schools and specifically focusing on small and rural school districts.
Districts and schools that need the most help in delivering meals to their students.
And so these efforts will include kitchen updates and renovations, redesigning food preparation and service spaces, as well as other school district-led efforts to support school meals and school nutrition professionals.
As you heard, the grants are being issued for USDA by a group called Action for Healthy Kids. Rob Besegli is the group CEO.
This is a historic investment by the USDA in school nutrition and will reach students in some of our nation's highest need schools.
Rob says with these grants,
small and rural school districts will be able to modernize their operations and provide more nutritious meals that appeal to students while increasing culturally relevant foods in their communities.
Both Rob Besegli and Secretary Small say bringing good meals to the nation's children is more than just temporarily staving off their hunger.
It's important to make sure that kids get a healthy meal that will help them during this formative time to be able to learn at their best and also grow into healthy adults.
All kids deserve to be healthy, both in body and mind, and that healthy children create a better world.
Which is almost exactly what President Harry Truman said back in 1946 when he signed the law creating the National School Lunch Program.
This is a vital part of the work of helping to make a healthier and happier life for all our children in the years ahead.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Today we are chatting with President and CEO of AgSafe, Teresa Keene. Teresa, thanks for chatting with me today on a topic, you know, that I really thought we were done talking about, at least for a while, and that's the increases in minimum wage. But however, much to my surprise, the state is issuing more increases. So why don't you go ahead and give us a breakdown of our current minimum wage rate and how we've gotten here over the last several years.
Absolutely. So we've, in the state of California, we have been experiencing minimum wage increases for the last several years. It was due to legislation that was to get us up to $15 an hour by 2023. And we are now there. And actually, in January, we went beyond $15 an hour and went to $15.50. And so employers are now in 2023, you know, working against that. However, we've got another increase that is scheduled for 2024.
That's right. And that's what we're talking about today. So
Can you tell me why, if that mandatory rate was set to stop at $15 an hour this year, that instead this year's rate is $15.50 and next year's is $16?
Okay, so built into that legislation, so once we got to that $15 an hour mark, the legislation had also popped in kind of this inflation increase as well to make sure that minimum wage was keeping up with the rate of inflation. So in the legislation, it says that minimum wage can increase each year up to about 3.5%. And so that has happened. And so we are now looking at 2024. We just heard that it's going to go to $16 an hour, whether or not you are a small employer or a large employer. So it's across the board, $16 an hour is what the going minimum wage will be for 2024. So everybody that's a planner out there and is working on budget, so you can start to figure that into your operations for next year.
And that's for employers of any size, correct? And with any amount of employee, be it a large operation or a small operation, because I know there was, you know, some different brackets that if you were a small employer, you know, you had a few years that you had to meet those requirements. And if you were a larger employer, you had to meet them more immediately.
Yes, yes. And so the governor last year had bumped everyone up to $15.50. Small employers were thinking that they were going to have a bit of a break, but he just went ahead and across the board did it to $15.50. And so now everybody is on the same level playing field, I guess. And now we're all looking at $16 an hour next year.
Teresa, not every worker gets paid by the hour. I don't. I'm a salary worker. So does this increase in minimum wage also include those workers or salaried workers?
Yes. So that is a great question. And this is a piece I think that a lot of folks miss. And so for your exempt employees, so essentially they mean exempt from overtime. It's your managers and your supervisors that have duties that can make financial decisions. They direct people's work. All of those folks essentially get double of the minimum wage. So now it goes to essentially like when you're doing the math, it's $32 an hour at 40 hours per week for like an annual salary this next coming year of $66,526. Wow, which is an increase of just a tick over $2,000 from 2023.
I feel like this has to present some challenges to employers. This has got to be tough, considering employers are already dealing with labor challenges altogether.
Absolutely. I think everybody's trying to do the math right now and figure out how they're going to make it work. You know, coupled with, you know, labor shortages, it just becomes really, really complex. The other thing I wanted to mention as well is that is the state minimum wage. Local cities and counties can also have their own minimum wages that are above and beyond what the state requires. So, for example, if you are in Half Moon Bay, it is $16.45 an hour. Santa Rosa, which we've got a lot of folks in our wine industry are up there, their minimum wage is $17.06 an hour. So you want to make sure that you are also taking a look at the cities and the counties that you're working in and ensure that you are meeting their minimum wage as well. So that's an important note.
Teresa, now is this something that is more or less like a one or a two-time increase? Or is this something that now employers are going to have to think about year after year as our economy continues to go up and go down? Is this something that they're just going to have on the tops of their minds to pay this much, if not more, for good quality help?
Right. So I would suggest, and we've been warning our employers about this as well, like you're going to need to think about those increases every year. So that 3.5 is always in there. So think about when you're doing that budget, like it can go as far up as that 3.5%. And also, you know, there is a ballot initiative looking at increasing our minimum wage to $18 an hour. So I feel like, you know, minimum wage in California is going to continue to increase, and we're going to have to, you know, get really strategic with how we utilize our workforce and, you know, are there other options available to us?
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
As harvest begins, the American Seed Trade Association reminds farmers to be diligent in taking the proper precautions to ensure treated seed does not enter the domestic or export grain supply. When properly handled, seed treatments are an effective agronomic tool that provides seeds the necessary protection for a strong, healthy start. Completely remove all treated seed left in containers and equipment used to handle harvested grain and dispose of it properly. Always be careful to follow state and federal guidelines for proper handling, storage, and disposal of treated seed. For more information, visit seed-treatment-guide.com or contact your seed dealer.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Crops may be at risk of damage from Hurricane Hillary. USDA's Rod Bain talks with USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
High winds and torrential rains, dangerous flash flooding, those are what Hurricane Hillary will likely be bringing to Southern California and on into Arizona in the days after the storm makes landfall in the wee hours of Monday morning. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says the storm could cause problems for several crops along the storm's path.
We do have to be concerned with Pima cotton. 94% of the U.S. Pima cotton crop comes out of California and Arizona. 100% of the nation's commercial lemon crop comes out of that region, as well as about 4/5 of the limes and a significant portion of citrus. So we will have to watch those winds as they intersect cotton and citrus production areas.
The last time a major Pacific hurricane made landfall on the U.S. West Coast was back in 1939, the year the movie Gone with the Wind was released.
Ruby goes on to say that some of the U.S. Pima cotton could be vulnerable to damage from the remnants of Hurricane Hillary.
We do have to be concerned with Pima cotton, a major crop across parts of California and the desert Southwest. 94% of the U.S. Pima cotton crop comes out of California and Arizona. 47% cotton bolls open in Arizona, none yet in California. So the crop's further ahead in Arizona, more susceptible to wind and rain-related damage there.
The American Society of Agricultural Consultants will be holding its 2023 annual conference in Fresno in November. The conference will be taking place November 5th through the 7th at the Wyndham Garden Fresno Airport, and the theme for this year's event will be Go West, Stake Your Claim in Ag Consulting. An opening reception will kick off the event on the evening of Sunday, November 5th. A macroeconomic update will begin the morning of Monday, November 6th, followed by a presentation from the National Ag Law Center. A panel discussion on water rights and regulations will take place in the afternoon after a presentation on ag technology. Tuesday will include a presentation on ethics in ag consulting, followed by tours in the afternoon of processing and packaging facilities, a green waste recycling plant, and a winery with a wine tasting. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
USDA's Federal Milk Marketing Order Modernization Hearing begins Wednesday, and dairy farmers are eager to be part of the process. National Milk Producers Federation Director of Economic Research and Analysis, Stephen Kane, says there is a lot of ground to cover.
It's a big process. We don't do these very often. You know, last time we had a big process like this, it was about 20 years ago. We developed a big package that we think is going to help the U.S. dairy farmer, but we're not the only kids on the block. There's some other groups in there that have some differing opinions, so we're going to have a good time explaining to USDA why I think some of these changes need to be made and why we think they need to be instituted in the way that we think they need to be done.
NMPF has spent 2 years preparing for the hearing, taking insights from the industry to craft proposals.
We've got kind of 5 key proposal pieces. A couple of the big ones, though, are looking at the class one mover adjustment. You know, we went to an average of 3 and 4 a few years ago that had some kind of unintended consequences. We're looking to go back to another mover now. It's called the higher of. Another key piece here is the make allowance adjustments. Updating those, make sure that they're in line with how the industry is operating today.
The hearing in Carmel, Indiana is expected to last a few weeks as USDA hears testimony from the dairy industry.
USDA is going to announce kind of a recommended decision here early at the beginning of next year, probably in February, March. And then we'll have some time for comments back and forth before they issue their final decision. It's likely going to come out in the June, July timeframe next year. So that'll be the big piece where everyone will kind of get a general idea of what the updates are going to be. And then after that, USDA will hold a referendum for each of the orders, allow them to vote in the changes if they'd like to, and then we'll finally get those fully effective there later in the fall of next year.
Kane adds the goal of the effort is to benefit U.S. dairy farmers.
We're trying to make sure that things stay in line with how the industry operates today. You can imagine the industry's changed over 20 years, and some of these pieces of the orders have been updated in that time. So we're not looking to make some huge groundbreaking changes. This is more of a modernization effort. So we're making sure that all the things we're doing here is to the benefit of the U.S. dairy farmer, make sure that they're adequately being compensated, that they're being treated fairly. And really one of the big pieces here that we've done this time as well is to make sure that all of the changes and the updates that we're looking to make are future-proof, making sure that we don't have these huge swaths of time where the industry gets out of line with the orders. At the end of the day, we think we have a really strong package of proposals that really can benefit the U.S. dairy farm and help them succeed.
Learn more at nmpf.org. Michael Clements reporting.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.